Diane Adams. My friends call me Dee Dee. I was born blind. My husband worked with visually impaired older folks. He would talk about the radio reader. He'd say, I ordered this radio reader for so-and-so, and so one day I said, I would really love to have one of those.
At the Illinois Radio Reader, local newspapers, books, and magazines, and periodicals are read and recorded by over 70 volunteers, and then those programs are broadcast to those visually impaired people who have our radios in their homes.
It is literally our newspaper. I feel we as visually impaired people are so privileged to have a service like this. I'm Dee Dee Adams from Decatur, and WILL is my source for the Illinois Radio Reader.
It's 2:41. In sports, Michigan State coach Tom Izzo says he doesn't know if injured point guard Kalen Lucas will be ready to play tomorrow against Purdue in a key Big Ten game. Number 10 Michigan State has a one-game lead in the conference over Wisconsin, Ohio State, and Illinois. Number 6 Purdue is close behind. The Spartans have lost back-to-back games at Wisconsin and Illinois after starting the Big Ten season with 9 straight wins. Lucas was injured against Wisconsin and missed the Illinois game. He leads the team in scoring at nearly 16 points per game. Kansas is again the runaway number one in the Associated Press's men's college basketball poll, and there's a different number two for the fourth straight week. Syracuse moves into the second spot today, its highest ranking since a six-week stretch at number one in 1989-1990. Kentucky, which was number one on two ballots, was third, while Villanova and West Virginia, which meet tonight, are fourth and fifth. The St. Louis Blues try to win their third straight road game tonight against the Colorado Avalanche. The Blues have played well on the road all season but are near the bottom of the NHL Western Conference standings because of a dismal home mark. And the Super Bowl was watched by more than 106 million people, surpassing the 1983 finale of MASH to become the most watched program in television history. The Nielsen Company estimated today that 106.5 million people watched the New Orleans Saints upset the Indianapolis Colts. That beats the MASH finale, which had close to 106 million viewers in an era when there were fewer television sets. The game also obliterated the previous record viewership for a Super Bowl, last year's game between Arizona and Pittsburgh, in which 98.7 million people watched. That's sports.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
Making medicine from things found in nature is not a new idea. Think aspirin, which originally came from the bark of willow trees. Now drugs derived from ocean animals are slowly making their way onto shelves. Samara Freemark talks to a researcher who helps get them there.
Mark Slattery is trying to find a cure for cancer. Slattery is a pharmacology professor at the University of Mississippi, but he doesn't really spend much time in the lab. Instead, he's usually in a wetsuit, scuba diving off the coasts of places like Guam and Antarctica. He's taking samples from tens of thousands of corals and sponges, looking for that one special species that might make a chemical that could cure disease. He calls it diving for cures.
In many ways, it's like going out and playing your super lotto or whatever. You know, you pick your eight numbers and then you see if you hit or not.
The idea is pretty simple. A third of the medicines on shelves today were derived from plants and animals that live on land. So ocean researchers got to thinking that the organisms they studied probably also produced a lot of useful chemicals. Take corals and sponges. They can't run away from predators, so instead they squirt out chemicals that poison the fish that try to take a bite out of them. Mark Slattery says those toxins are lethal for the fish, but it's possible they could be good for people.
Those particular compounds that tell a fish, not today, are the same ones that might tell the AIDS virus you can't replicate, or tell a cancer cell you're dead, or those kinds of things.
So Slattery and other researchers like him clip off bits of sponges and corals. When they go back to the lab, they extract the chemicals, which is really just a nice way of saying
sticking in a blender with methanol and hexanes and all those sorts of things that you used in organic chemistry lab. And then you sort of throw away the dead sponge, and the tarry residue that's left is the biochemistry that came out of that sponge.
So you make like a sponge smoothie.
Exactly.
Once they've extracted the chemicals, researchers test to see if they have any human application. If a compound looks promising, it moves on to clinical trials. Those trials can take decades, which is why ocean-derived drugs are only now starting to hit the market. So far, only two have been approved for use in the United States, a painkiller and a cancer drug marketed by Johnson & Johnson. I wondered how ocean conservationists felt about diving for cures, so I called up Sandra Brooke. She studies corals at the Marine Conservation Biology Institute. Brooke says she does worry that diving for cures could lead to over-harvesting.
Once something becomes valuable to people, there's a resistance to closing access to it. It becomes harder to regulate it.
But she says corals are under much greater and much more immediate threats. The biggest culprit? Industrial trawling. That's when fishermen scrape reefs off the ocean floor so they can get to the fish.
It's just like the clear cutting of the forest, except it's done on a much vaster scale. They are deliberately mowing down these deep water coral ecosystems that are thousands and thousands of years old, some of the oldest animals ever measured, and that's not going to come back, not in our lifetime, not in many lifetimes.
There's also the fact that oceans are changing as the climate does. Those changes mean corals are becoming weaker. Mark Slattery thinks he might be seeing that in a Pacific reef he's been studying for 15 years.
When we went back and started looking at it, we noticed that there was a change in the chemistry through time. As things have heated up on the reefs, there's a physiological effect that has cascaded down into their ability to produce the chemistry that we're used to seeing. Early on, it was so apparent, you know, it was always there, and now they seem to be able to produce less of it.
That means that today the cure for cancer might be out there in some coral reef, but it could be gone tomorrow. For the Environment Report, I'm Samara Freemark.
James Hansen is the author of The Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe, and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. He's been a climate scientist for NASA and was the first scientist to testify before Congress about climate change. In the book, Hansen wrote about climate change. We seem oblivious to the danger, unaware how close we may be to our demise. Lester Graham talked to Hansen and noted, we don't often hear strong language like that from scientists.
Well, the public is unaware of the situation, and that's partly because of the way nature works. You know, weather is highly variable. 10 or 20 or 30 degree variations are common, while the global warming so far is about 1 degree Celsius, which is about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. So people have a hard time seeing it, but the consequences are already becoming apparent, as we see with the melting sea ice in the Arctic. The Northwest Passage is now actually open. Mountain glaciers melting around the world, subtropics expanding, which is affecting the Southwest United States and the Mediterranean region and Australia. And the problem is that those things are going to grow, and we're going to pass tipping points, which will have disastrous consequences if we pass them. We don't have to pass them, though, and that's why it's appropriate for us to try to communicate the situation to the public, because the kind of things that we need to do with our energy systems make sense anyway for different reasons.
The evidence for climate change is growing almost every week. More studies are released, often indicating the future will be worse than first thought. What do you think we need to do to minimize the effects of climate change?
Well, it's very clear what we need to do. The carbon dioxide is increasing because of the burning of fossil fuels. If you look at how much carbon there is in oil, gas, and coal, you see that coal is by far the biggest reservoir. And then there's the unconventional fossil fuels like tar shale and tar sands. What we need to do is phase out the coal use and prohibit the use of these unconventional, dirty fossil fuels, and we could solve the problem. But to get there, there's a very practical requirement, and that is that we begin to put a price on carbon emissions. The reason that people use fossil fuels as the main source of energy is that it's the cheapest energy. And as long as that's the case, we're going to keep using them more and more. But the reason they're cheapest is because we subsidize them. Our governments subsidize them, and they don't make them pay for the costs that they cause for society. The human health problems due to air pollution and water pollution, the mercury and the arsenic that comes from coal, and the costs of future climate change for our children and grandchildren. All of these are free for the fossil fuel companies. They don't have to worry about those at all. The way we would solve that is to put a gradually rising price on carbon emissions. And there's actually some good news in the newspaper, and that is that Senators Kerry, a Democrat, and Lindsey Graham, a Republican, announced that they're not going to push cap and trade, which had been the big bank's proposed solution to put a cap on carbon emissions. And then it was a complicated system where you could trade the rights to pollute, but the big winners would be the traders and the losers would be the public.
James Hansen is a climate scientist for NASA and the author of the book Storms of My Grandchildren. He spoke with the Environment Report's Lester Graham. We'll hear more from Hansen tomorrow, including his idea on how to reduce using fossil fuels. The Executive Mansion in Springfield is the official residence of the governor. But while politicians come and go, for the past quarter century, there has been one constant at the home. Illinois Public Radio's Jenna Dooley reports.
Helen Hoffman is just shy of her 90th birthday, but you wouldn't know it. The feisty redhead still takes tourists up and down the Executive Mansion's winding stairs and doesn't miss a beat.
Where you came in, that used to be storage and laundry. But it was during the Tanner administration that that
But it's the behind-the-scenes stories that people clamor to hear from Helen.
Samantha Thompson, who would slide down the banister, who would stand up here, and that she did on my watch, that she would stand up here and she spit down to the bottom.
Now a widow, Helen came to Springfield by way of Minnesota in 1978 with her husband and six children. Helen's husband was a Springfield reverend, and she says they toured the historic sites when they first came to the city. Her love of the mansion never went away, and she later became a docent, leading visitors through the more than 150-year-old structure. And she swells with pride when she remembers meeting each governor in the last 2.5 decades.
I have even met Blagojevich.
She says she had the most interaction with former Governor George Ryan and his wife Laura Lynn.
When they had open house here on Christmas, the first Sunday in December, and the docents came a little early and for picture taken. And so Mrs. Ryan is on one side of Mr. Ryan and I'm on the other. And Mr. Ryan had his arms around us and he said, you know, it can't get any better than this. A blonde on one arm and a redhead on the other. So.
In the mansion's lobby, Georgia Northrup greets Helen like a playground best friend. They embrace and giggle and start the same shift they have shared for 25 years at the mansion. You could call Georgia the straight man to Helen's character.
She's very warm in conducting her tours. Oh, she's just a beautiful person.
25 years,
yes,
I would say.
Yes,
so
yes.
We've seen a lot happen in this house since then.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Helen's impression is made well beyond friends and visitors. David Borland is the mansion's curator.
She keeps me in my place. She makes sure that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing and is not afraid to tell me that I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
It wasn't long into my interview with Mr. Borland when I got my proof.
Well, you know, everything we have here is old. And
the
everything
the table
you...
when I came here did not have that white spot on it from one of those hibachi or whatever you want to call it. And that other scratch, we're not here. I mean, the scratches bother us.
Bothers me.
Yeah. And I've been here longer than you.
And I'm taller than you. And it really bothers me. See, look at that hair. It gets red when she starts pointing her fingers at me. It really gets red.
Kidding aside, Borland says Helen is rarely stumped by tourists, and she can highlight any area of the home with accuracy and energy.
Well, I don't want them to be dry. I want them to be interesting. I want you to remember, you know, interesting thing.
As far as energy, when I asked Helen how long she plans to continue giving tours, she expects to be around for the foreseeable future.
I certainly want to be here till the next administration, so we'll see.
After all, it's Helen's house, too.
We have two fireplaces that still burn wood. All the rest of them.
I'm Jenna Dooley.
One can look at old Valentines and imagine a time when love really meant something. But commentator Amy Guida rips off the rose-colored glasses and looks to law for a harsh reality. Here's this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
There's this wonderful antique Valentine posted to the internet. It features a cherub with a dove in one hand and a budding rose in the other. A white ribbon forms a heart around this poem. May this bow of white, which gives delight, and which I send you a token be of love divine. O, will it thou be my Valentine? Ah, to return to the days of inexplicable contractions, the good old days of real romance. Or were they? You might think that couples had no troubles back 150 years ago, when cherubs walked the earth holding birds and flowers, and we used words like will it. After all, that was back when technology prevented fights over the TV clicker. But couples back then had major troubles, too, and no place is that more clear than within the law of breach of promise to marry, a sort of policing of romance that's still on the books in the land of Lincoln. Put succinctly, breach of promise to marry allows the wronged would-be spouse, the one left at the altar, say, to sue his or her intended for promising to wed and then getting wet feet. If you think that sounds sort of unfair, you'd be in line with today's legislators to an extent. Today, the Breach of Promise to Marry Act gives those wronged the right to sue for only limited damages, basically out-of-pocket expenses, but see your favorite attorney for a more detailed description. After all, legislators note, you can't throw enough money at pains of the heart to make them disappear. But back in the good old days of cherubs, we sure did. Money may not have cured the heartache, but it put a happy jingle in one's pocketbook. And quite frankly, romance seemed much more complicated back then, and the emotional damages all the more real. Take a wronged woman's reputation. There is a total loss of character, and all hopes of future happiness and usefulness are blighted, the Illinois Supreme Court sympathized in 1859, and future misery, if not crime, are its consequences. That decision built on one from the same decade in which an exasperated court criticized all who found themselves in a fading relationship and became scoundrels. Such a man, if he deserves the name, is entitled to no sympathy at the hands of either juries or courts, but should be made to respond in heavy damages for more real suffering and distress. Meantime, the wronged woman back then didn't have to hold back. One male defendant argued that after he'd broken off the engagement, his intended let loose in what the court described as strong, if not indelicate, language, that she didn't wish to marry him anyway. That sort of response was to be expected, the court reasoned, because, quote, a discarded girl, when badgered on the subject, can hardly be expected to speak with the caution and circumspection